my article in Earth Island Journal in the coming days.
Well, great. Well, thank you for that. I will be looking for that. Paul Koberstein, thanks so much for joining me again on Coast Range Radio, and thank you so much for the great work that you do. Best of luck, and let's talk again soon.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's it for this episode of Coast Range Radio. Coast Range Radio is an independent production. If you like the show, please help me grow the audience, tell your friends about it, follow us on Instagram. Best of all, directly share it with a couple folks by texting the link to our podcast feed. Once again, the show email is coastrangeradio@gmail.com. Reach out anytime. Thank you so much for listening. Let's make it through this together.
Radio's greatest application is in broadcasting mass entertainment. Probably one of the best ways to get started is to make it a hobby and build an amateur station. It will show you more quickly than anything else whether or not you can succeed in radio.
KBOO, Portland.
Support for KBOO comes from our members and from the Urban League of Portland, celebrating its 80th anniversary as a local civil rights organization. Urban League PDX provides housing, education, healthcare, and career services to local communities. Membership information at ulpdx.org.
One day I got a letter from my two friends in Little Beach saying they were going to publish a monthly newsletter because there were a lot of gays in the Air Corps, among the higher ranks as well as the PFCs and the privates. So they produced a newsletter which they called the Moto Beach Bitch. They wrote about who was going with who was sleeping with who. Her wartime coming out experience so radically changed her life that immediately after the war, she started the first lesbian newsletter in the United States, which she called Vice Versa. Unlike the Moto Beach Bitch, copies of Vice Versa still survive.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Brian DeShazer. Burkina Faso outlaws queer sex. Pope Leo offers queer Catholics Francis-like friendship. And Alan Barabé finds queer media pioneers in the U.S. military. Those stories and more this week, now that you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Lucia Chappelle.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending September 6th, 2025. Burkina Faso is outlawing same-gender sex. The signature of military junta president Ibrahim Traoré is a foregone conclusion following the unanimous vote of the unelected 71-member transitional parliament. The ban on queer sex is a first for the Northwest African former French colony. Amendments to the Persons and Family Code passed on September 1st prohibit what Justice Minister Adaso Rodrique Bayala called homosexuality or similar practices, as well as bizarre behavior. The punishment is up to 5 years in prison and fines of the equivalent of up to $17,800. Bayala also said that foreign repeat offenders would be deported. Amnesty International Regional Director for West and Central Africa, Marcel Siviud, welcomed some of the family code reforms. The minimum age for marriage is set at 18. Gender discrimination in inheritance rights is eliminated because consent between two parties is established as the basis of marriage. However, Siviud called the inclusion of the criminalization of same-gender sex alarming. He says that the ban violates the African Charter on Human and People's Rights and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights that the country has previously ratified. Human Rights Watch has also expressed concerns ever since the junta took power 3 years ago. The international organization charges the new government with what it calls serious abuses, further degrading the country's human rights and humanitarian situation. African LGBTQ activist, actor, playwright, and poet Frank Malaba finds it typical for a government he says is facing insecurity, poverty, and displacement due to conflict with armed groups to target LGBTQ people as scapegoats. Malaba says, today it's queer people. Tomorrow it could be women's rights, journalists, or dissenters. A government that dictates whom you can love will not stop there.
Pope Leo XIV intends to follow in his predecessor's footsteps when it comes to the queer community, according to Father James Martin. The New York Jesuit author, editor, and advocate had a 30-minute audience with the Pope at the Vatican on September 1st. Father Martin writes on his outreach blog, the message I received from him, loud and clear, was that he wanted to continue with the same approach that Pope Francis had advanced, which was one of openness and welcome. He described the pontiff as warm, relaxed, and serene, and funny. Recognizing that Leo's current priorities include major issues such as peace in Gaza, Ukraine, Myanmar, and other hotspots, Martin says he offered 5 steps for dioceses and parishes to take to welcome LGBTQ Catholics. He suggested that congregations can acknowledge their existence in the church, listen to their testimonies and needs, establish outreach efforts, include them in programs, and advocate for them when incidents of violence, bullying, and harassment occur. While some of the meeting was off the record, Father Martin could say, my overall sense is that he gets it and that he is ready to continue Francis's legacy of openness, and that is surely good news.
Moroccan feminist human rights activist Ibtisham Lashgar is heading to jail for more than 2 years for her Allah is Lesbian t-shirt. The Rabat primary court also imposed a fine equivalent of $5,500 for violations of the country's laws against blasphemy. Defense attorney Mohammed Khattab says an appeal is forthcoming to challenge the 30-month sentence handed down on September 3rd. Moroccan Association for Human Rights President Hakim Sukuk found the sentence shocking and called it an attack on free expression. The case has also drawn condemnation from several global human rights groups. Lashgar is a 50-year-old psychologist criminologist. Co-founder of the Alternative Movement for Individual Freedoms, she's well known in Morocco for her activism on behalf of the rights of women and LGBTQ people. She was arrested for offending Islam on August 10th, about a week and a half after she posted a picture of herself on social media wearing the Allah is Lesbian t-shirt. She's been behind bars ever since. Lashgar described the message on her t-shirt to one judge during the proceedings as a feminist slogan which has existed for years against ideologies and violence against women and has no connection to the Islamic faith. Lashgar is reportedly being treated for cancer and needs critical surgery on her left arm, but the judges have rejected repeated requests for temporary release. One of her attorneys told Morocco World News, she could die at any time in prison. We explained this to the court.
4 people arrested for attempting to restore the Rainbow Crosswalk near the Pulse Nightclub Memorial in Orlando were quickly released. Florida's Republican Governor Ron DeSantis wrote on social media, we will not allow our state roads to be commandeered for political purposes, and ordered all rainbow crosswalks in the state turned back to standard black and white markings. Cities are being threatened with the loss of state funding if they don't comply. Activists have been using chalk to restore the rainbow colors to the Pulse adjacent crosswalk ever since Trump administration officials ordered it painted over on August 20th. Some inscribed phrases like, "Right to free speech," "You can't erase us," and "Love wins" in spaces between the rainbow colors. Supportive protesters chanted, "Shame, shame, shame," as highway patrol officers arrested the chalkers. Some supporters then marched about a mile from the Pulse Memorial to Orlando City Hall and chalked rainbows outside the municipal building. A judge refused to pursue charges of criminal mischief and felonious interference with a traffic control device against the four who were detained. Despite the rain repeatedly washing away the chalked rainbows and the police posting warnings that read, "Defacing sidewalk prohibited," the protesters showed no signs of giving up.
Finally, world-famous diving champ Greg Louganis is taking the plunge on a journey of self-discovery. He's auctioned off 3 of his 5 Olympic medals, sold his Southern California home, parted with most of his possessions, and left the United States for Panama. A record-breaking Olympian from 1976 to 1988, Louganis publicly came out as gay in 1994 and announced that he was HIV positive in 1995. He wrote on Facebook that this new chapter in his life was motivated by the recent devastating fires in the Los Angeles area. In his words, "I had many friends, people I was close to, lost everything. I know I am choosing to do this, but their resilience is an inspiration for me to start anew with an open heart and an open door." At 65, he also admitted, "I needed the money. While many people may have built businesses and sold them for a profit, I had my medals, which I am grateful for. If I had proper management, I might not have been in that position, but what is done, live and learn." Louganis went on to explain his decision in Instagram live posts before and after his departure.
"Oftentimes, we don't realize how much we hang on to. You know, what I'm also learning now in this process is how much oftentimes we don't realize they weigh us down. Actually, I was discussing that with Michael Phelps, you know, because he heard I auctioned my medals. I said, "How was that?" I said, "You know what? It was a relief. I made it to Panama City." I know a lot of friends are wondering. I lost my mind. Yeah, it's true. I probably did lose my mind, but trying to find it. I remember last year I was in Paris at the Olympics. It's like, I didn't want to be here. Not that I didn't want to be in Paris. I didn't want to be on this earth. But now I'm realizing I have things to offer. What that is and what that looks like, I haven't figured it out. And I think that that's what this is kind of about.
Olympic diver Greg Louganis.
I'm just embracing the I don't know and also staying open for discovery.
That's NewsWrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending September 6th, 2025. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap is written by Greg Gordon and myself, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Michael LeBeau. Stay healthy.
And I'm Lucy Chappell. Stay safe.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
Military personnel will have to shower with homosexual.
To accept the principle that homosexuals can't shower with other people is a degree of discrimination that goes far beyond this. I mean, we don't get ourselves dry cleaned.
Hello, I'm Barney Frank, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international radio show for all our sexually diverse communities.
The year is 1948. The place, Singapore.
No perfume on guard duty. No drag on sentry gear, eh? Properly dressed, six bearers.
A story of how war can turn boys into men, and men into... yeah.
Oh, yes, quite right. Pretty as a picture.
The obscure 1983 British dramedy Privates on Parade tells one story of World War II-era drag performers in the military. The late gay historian Alan Barrabay told another one. This Way Out's David Hunt recalls a presentation by Barrabay coincidentally around the same time that movie came out, and he was fascinated to learn that the modern queer press actually began with a couple of soldiers known for their hit drag shows in the early 1940s. It was 14 years ago this month that the U.S. government repealed its Don't Ask, Don't Tell prohibition against out active gay and lesbian service members. As we speak, transgender service members are being eliminated by the Trump administration, an administration also bent on erasing any trace of minority representation in history. So it's a fine time to document the legacy of LGBTQ plus people in the military and their role in building a foundation of queer journalism. Here's David Hunt.
There are hundreds, perhaps thousands, of news outlets serving the LGBTQ community around the world. From the Star Observer in Sydney, Australia, to QX Magazine in Stockholm, Sweden. Some, like The Advocate in the United States, have been around since before Stonewall. Most go back just a decade or two at most. There was a time, not that long ago, when the very idea of a newspaper or magazine for queer readers was unthinkable. It took a world war to change that. I'm David Hunt. In 1983, I met historian Alan Barrabay at the annual convention of the Gay and Lesbian Press Association in San Francisco. Barrabay was researching a book documenting the lives of gay and lesbian service members during the Second World War. That book, Coming Out Under Fire, would come out in 1990 and earn Barrabay a Lambda Literary Award. In his research, Barrabay interviewed scores of older gays and lesbians, leading to a startling discovery. The first queer publication in the U.S. wasn't one magazine, as widely believed. It was a gossipy newsletter published a decade earlier in the early 1940s by members of the U.S. Army stationed at an airfield in the Deep South. Barrabay recounted his findings in a presentation to the convention. Let's listen in.
In 1943, Norman, one of the men that I've interviewed, was sent to Hunter Field, an Army Air Force base near Savannah, Georgia, as part of the Special Services Unit there. Special Services put on entertainment for the troops. We were putting on a musical comedy, he remembers. During the rehearsals, they found out that there was a time slot that needed to be filled. Well, I had two buddies, and the three of us decided that we would do a comedy drag routine. So we got together a little skit and wrote a little song, and we did a dry run for the cast and crew, and they really loved it. It broke the knot. The next day, we went into downtown Savannah, and we walked into this dress shop and happened to find a woman there who was quite liberated for her time. We told her that we were doing the show, and could she contribute some dresses? Well, she was absolutely blown out of her mind to see three soldiers walk in and ask for dresses. But she was very cooperative, and she took us into the dressing room where we trod on a lot of gowns. And she gave them to us for free, for the war effort, she said. With the understanding that she and her husband could have complimentary tickets to attend the performance. Well, the first night of our show, light in the middle of our act and our song, there was a blackout, which happened in those days, and when the lights came back on, this bee that had a nest in the wings of the theater came out and stung me right on the nose, and I fell off the stage right into the lap of a colonel in the front row. Everybody thought it was part of the act, so we were asked to keep it in. Each night, we ended the act by coming out for an encore, and after the applause died down, we lifted our dresses and roller skated off the stage, just like Bee Lilly. She was a comedy singer at that time. From Hunter Field, I was transferred to Walterboro, South Carolina, and my two friends were transferred to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina.
One day, I got a letter from my two friends in Myrtle Beach saying they were going to publish a monthly newsletter because there were a lot of gays in the Air Corps, among the higher ranks as well as the PFCs and the privates.
So they produced a newsletter which they called the Myrtle Beach Bitch. They wrote about who was going with who was sleeping with who divorced each other and was going with someone else. And so the Myrtle Beach Bitch went on for quite some time, and it was almost like receiving a newsletter from home, because it was the only communication we had about people we had met in other bases, and it let us know who was overseas and where they were. It was just a mimeograph standard-sized piece of paper, and maybe it consisted of 4 or 5 sheets that were stapled together. And it was mailed to those people who were on the mailing list, and they in turn would give it to someone else, and if they wanted to be on the mailing list, they would just go ahead and send in their name. You see, people didn't save things in those days because we were all so afraid, not only of the service, but of our families. But people saved the Myrtle Beach Bitch. Well, what happened was the Myrtle Beach Bitch got into the hands of someone who turned it in. The two fellows who produced it had made the mistake of not camouflaging or changing the names. They just used the actual names. Well, there was a big purge. All the men whose names had appeared in the newsletter were called before the board, they were reviewed, and they were interrogated. There were hundreds involved. My two friends at Myrtle Beach were court-martialed and convicted for using the government mails to send vile and obscene materials. They were sentenced to 1 year and 1 month at Fort Leavenworth Federal Penitentiary. My name also came up on the Myrtle Beach Bitch mailing list, and they called me in. They wanted to know if I had known any of these people. They had a whole list of a couple of hundred names of people that were in Savannah, and people that were in South Carolina, and people that were in North Carolina, and even overseas, and they wanted to know how many I had had sexual contact with. I denied having sex with any of them because I didn't want to put anybody on the spot. They sent me to psychiatrists, and then they interrogated me, and then they put me in the hospital under observation in a locked prison ward with German prisoners of war. The next thing I remember, I was in JCPenney's, and they bought me a civilian suit because I was not allowed to wear the uniform, and they put me on a bus back home to New Jersey. And that was the end of my service. And that was the end of the Myrtle Beach Bitch.
You're listening to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm David Hunt. In a presentation to the Gay and Lesbian Press Association in 1983, historian Alan Barabe revealed how service members published what was likely the first gay newsletter in the U.S. during World War II. The first known lesbian newsletter was created a few years later. Barabe continues the story.
Toward the end of World War II, a woman named Lisa Benn, that's her pseudonym, she rearranged the letters in the word lesbian to make the word Lisa Benn. Pretty ingenious. Toward the end of World War II, Lisa Benn left her parents' home in a small Northern California town up here and took a bus down to Los Angeles to find secretarial work in the movie studios there. She moved into a women's boarding house, where she met other gay women for the first time. They lived on the floor above her. They introduced her to lesbian social life by taking her to women's softball games and dancing at the IP Club, a lesbian bar in Los Angeles. Her wartime coming out experience so radically changed her life that immediately after the war, she started the first lesbian newsletter in the United States, which she called Vice Versa. A few years ago, Lisa Benn described to Lula Moss, a writer for Gays Week in New York, how she started up her little magazine in 1947. I had a lot of time to myself when I was secretary in the movie studio, she recalled, and the boss was at a lot, so I decided I would make up a little magazine to while away the time. I thought I'd make up a gay magazine because I had never seen any on the newsstands. I thought it would be great if it were a real magazine with a printing press and all that, but I couldn't do that, so I typed it out in my typewriter. In those days, we didn't have Xerox machines, so I'd type 6 copies at a time, 5 carbons and 1 original.
I typed the whole magazine page by page, then I'd begin over again and type six more, so that each printing there were only 12 copies, which made it a darned exclusive magazine. I didn't really want it to be that exclusive, but I had no other recourse. There would be a preamble, a movie review. There were very few movies that dealt with that subject in those days, but even if there was one that only hinted at it, I would plow it up. And I'd write poetry, and maybe a short story. I would entreat my readers to send in articles and stories too, because I wasn't that prolific, and I felt like I would run out after a while, if not of time and opportunity, then of my materials. So a few girls sent in some poems and some little items of this and that, but they didn't really get into it, and I wish they had. It was a very slim magazine, maybe about 9 pages in one, 16 in the next. But the reason it was so slim was that it was so very hard to turn it out, and that if anybody came around, I had to zip it into my briefcase quick on that desk drawer. But I had a lot of fun doing it, and I would give it away to my friends. There was one stipulation. I didn't want to make money off it. I just wanted to give it away. I had no idea how daring or dangerous this was. I used to mull them blithely out from the place where I worked until somebody said, don't you know you could get in trouble for mailing this? I didn't know why. There were no four-letter words or pictures in it, nothing that could be misconstrued as something sexual. I didn't name the names of places where people congregated, but they said, we're telling you for your own good, you'd better not do that anymore. So I took their advice and distributed them personally, and I'd say, when you're through with it, pass it on, because there aren't that many of them, and I'd like to get them to as many people as I can. So that was the story about my gay magazine, Vice Versa, and it went on for 9 months. Unlike the Myrtle Beach Bitch, copies of Vice Versa still survive. And I have a Xerox copy of one of them here if you want to look at it later. The first issue, which Lisa Ben typed up for distribution in June of 1947, began with this explanation. Have you ever stopped to enumerate the many different publications to be found on the average newsstand? Yet there is one kind of publication which has never appeared on the stands. Newsstands carrying the crudest kind of magazines appealing to the vulgar would find themselves severely censured were they to display this utter type of publication. Why? Because society decrees it thus. Hence the appearance of Vice Versa, a magazine dedicated, in all seriousness, to those of us who will never quite be able to adapt ourselves to the iron-bound rules of convention. A few issues later, in response to a reader's letter praising the magazine, Lisa Ben wrote, "Your letter is very flattering. I have never considered Vice Versa as a courageous venture. I believe that there is a definite need for such a magazine among the gay folk. Vice Versa was long a fond dream of mine ere it came into reality in June 1947. It is my personal contribution to others of my ilk, meant to provide an outlet for the creative self-expression so often of necessity pent up within us." And finally, in an article entitled Here to Stay, Lisa Ben reveals her dream for the future. Whether the unsympathetic majority approves or not, it looks as though the third sex is here to stay. Nightclubs featuring male and female impersonators are becoming increasingly prevalent. Even cafes and drive-ins intended for the average customer, when repeatedly patronized by inverts, tend to reflect a gay atmosphere. Books such as Diana and The Well of Loneliness are now available at bookmarts and even drugstores. With such knowledge being disseminated through fact and fiction to the public, homosexuality is becoming less and less a taboo subject, and although still considered by the public as contemptible, I venture to predict that there will be a time in the future when gay folk will be accepted as part of regular society. Perhaps even Vice Versa might be the forerunner of better magazines dedicated to the third sex, which, in some future time, might take their rightful place on the newsstands beside other publications to be available openly and without restriction to those who wish to read them.
You've been listening to a 1983 recording of historian Alan Barabay, author of Coming Out Under Fire, discussing the first LGBTQ newsletters in the U.S., the forerunners of today's queer media. Sadly, Barabay died in 2007. I'd like to thank the One National Gay and Lesbian Archives at the University of Southern California for preserving this recording. For This Way Out, I'm David Hunt.
Thank you for choosing This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. News Wrap was reported this week by Lucia Chappell and Michael LeBeau and produced by Brian DeShazer. David Hunt produced this week's feature. The Zombies, Emerson, Lake and Palmer, Barbara Streisand, Adam Dibb, and Anthony Lazzaro performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks Richard Merck and Brad Payton, celebrating their 50th year together, Harry Richardson of Socorro, New Mexico, and all the listener donors who make this program possible. Ask us how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078 USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon, associate producer Lucia Chappell, and the entire This Way Out crew, I'm Brian DeShazer. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And on KHEN, Salida, Colorado, WWUH, West Hartford, Connecticut, BridgeRadioPA.com, Perth Andover, New Brunswick, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
This is Dr. Caldicott talking on 90.7 FM KBOO. You all realize how terribly important this radio station is now that the federal government is trying to cut funds for national public radio. And you all realize that the real truth only comes out of public radio, and that all the rest of the media is compromised and represents the corporations who are destroying the earth. So you absolutely have to support KBOO with lots of money now. It's imperative, and you all know that.
I was the executive director of Outright International, and we did a lot of advocacy at the United Nations because LGBTQI people in many parts of the world couldn't receive justice within national borders. In my time in the State Department, we placed an enormous focus on activating U.S. foreign policy so that all aspects from national security to economic development to public health had some relationship to LGBTQI plus rights.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Dutch Parliament moves to ban conversion therapy, Hong Kong lawmakers nix same-gender couples' rights, and expert advice for global queer rights advocates. Those stories and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Joe Bainline.
And I'm Melanie Keller.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending September 13th, 2025. The lower house of the Dutch parliament voted on September 9th to criminalize so-called conversion therapy. Initial opposition from conservative members of parliament's Tweede Kamer was allayed. Conversion therapy refers to the debunked practice of curing queer sexual orientation or gender identity through a combination of counseling and prayer. The bill's proponents stressed to those concerned about protecting pastoral conversations that it will only be a criminal offense to use systematic or intrusive methods utilizing severe psychological pressure. It took quite a while to arrange that compromise as the bill's supporters worked to gather a majority, according to Christian News in Europe. Social liberal MP Vika Palusma said after the vote, "Love does not need to be cured. With this law, we protect vulnerable people from harmful practices that endanger their health and safety. This is a choice for freedom, equality, and human dignity." Passage of the bill is a victory to Mattia Danso, chair of the venerable Dutch queer advocacy group COC, Nederland. She said, "You are perfect just the way you are. Never let anyone tell you otherwise." A victory in the upper house of parliament is still needed to make the ban on conversion to therapy the law of the land.
A bill to grant Hong Kong's same-gender couples limited legal rights was overwhelmingly voted down on September 10th. For gay and lesbian couples who either legally married or obtained civil unions overseas, it would have allowed registration of same-gender relationships for the first time in Hong Kong. Mutual medical decision-making and after-death arrangements were among the limited rights offered. 71 of the Legislative Council's 86 members rejected the government-backed measure, and one abstained. Legislator Maggie Chan was convinced the bill rocks the foundation of the monogamous and heterosexual marriage system in Hong Kong, as she told the Hong Kong Free Press. Famously anti-LGBTQ lawmaker Junius Ho fretted about how Father's Day and Mother's Day would be celebrated. Some opponents called it an opportunity to show that the Legislative Council is not a rubber stamp for the Hong Kong government. A knowledgeable source told the Washington Blade that Beijing was unlikely to interfere. Pressure is building on the Legislative Council. In September 2023, the Hong Kong Court of Appeal gave lawmakers until October 27th of this year to find some way to legally recognize same-gender couples. 60% of Hong Kongers supported marriage equality in a 2023 survey, cited by the Free Press.
Queers and their allies in the Ukrainian city of Kharkiv held LGBTQ plus Pride on September 6 in the very midst of the Russian invasion. Pride co-organizer and president of the Sphere Women's Association, Anna Sharihina, told the Washington Blade, "Kharkiv needs Kharkiv Pride, a powerful and vivid distinction from Russia." Organizers described an hour-long procession of about 50 LGBTQ activists, volunteers, and service members in 17 cars escorted by police vehicles. They said they drove through the city to draw attention to the importance of ensuring human rights for all through legislation. There have been successful and peaceful pride parades in Kyiv the past 2 years, but that kind of event in Kharkiv would have raised major security concerns. Ukraine's second largest city is less than 30 miles from the Russian border in the eastern part of the country. An undaunted Sharihina said, "We strive to live in a free and safe country and to have the same rights that heterosexual people already enjoy. Every day, LGBTQ plus people contribute to the victory, so the state must finally provide us with protection."
Transgender students in South Carolina can use campus bathrooms that align with their gender identity, for now. The U.S. Supreme Court has rejected the state's request for emergency relief to enforce its trans bathroom ban, a denial based on the standards applicable for obtaining emergency relief from this court. The nonprofit legal group Public Justice cheered. Contrary to South Carolina's insistence, trans students are not emergencies. The ruling maintains a lower court's injunction against the state law on sex-segregated facilities, while its constitutionality is being challenged. Far-right justices Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, and Neil Gorsuch wanted to grant the state's request to lift the injunction. The High Court's brusque, unsigned order only noted that it was not a ruling on the merits of the legal issues presented in the litigation. South Carolina's 2024 law threatens any public school with the loss of a quarter of its state funding if it allows transgender students to use appropriate restrooms. And now, 15-year-old transgender boy in Berkeley County was suspended for using the boys' bathroom. His family filed suit, represented by the advocacy group Alliance for Full Acceptance. A panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit in Richmond, Virginia, blocked the law in August. The appeals court relied on its own 2020 ruling in Grimm versus Gloucester County School Board. It had found that bathroom bans targeting transgender students violate both Title IX and the Equal Protection Clause of the U.S. Constitution. South Carolina is pointing to the Supreme Court's United States versus Scrimeti decision in June. Scrimeti did not deal with bathroom bans, but it did uphold Tennessee's ban on gender-affirming health care for minors. Several cases on transgender rights are already on the Supreme Court docket beginning in October. They include a challenge to Colorado's ban on so-called conversion therapy and a trans sports ban in West Virginia. In representing the South Carolina teen, Public Justice's press statement said of trans students, "They are not threats. They are young people looking to learn and grow at school, despite the state-mandated hostility they too often face."
Finally, Oregon state lawmaker Cyrus Javadi says he's had enough. The frustrated Republican represents Tillamook, Astoria, and other North Coast communities. He recounted his disappointments with his party in an extended Substack post. In his words, "Protecting Medicaid benefits for the nearly 60% of children in Tillamook and Clatsop counties, opposed. Keeping rural hospitals afloat, opposed. Preserving students' access to books that reflect who they are, opposed. Protecting the First Amendment rights of people different from ourselves, opposed. Not because the policies were flawed, but because helping me deliver for my district didn't fit the Republican Party's agenda." And so Javadi told Portland's KGW-TV News that he's bidding the Republicans a not-so-fond adieu.
"Since Donald Trump got into office, I've been somewhat concerned in just the way that he went about trying to solve problems or burn things down and watching the Republican Party. I determined that the party was moving on and I wasn't going to move on with it, and I was going to work with a party like the Democratic Party that was there for me over and over and over again to solve those problems that were important to Oregon and to the North Coast."
In June, Javadi was the only Republican to vote for a bill to prevent anti-queer book bans in schools because he said that reading helped his own gay son understand his identity. He told his colleagues, "Let's not teach our kids that their stories are too controversial to belong on the shelf." As unsubstantiated threats to mount a recall campaign against him circulate, Javadi insists that his values have not changed, and that Republicans have proven to be leaders who'd rather go viral than go fix roads. He plans to run for re-election as a Democrat. He would have faced almost certain defeat in the Republican primary, but it's not likely that a Democratic challenger will emerge. Either way, for Javadi, changing parties is not changing principles, or as he says, "I still believe in limited government, free speech, fiscal responsibility, individual liberty, and the rule of law. I still believe your rights don't come from the state, but from something higher. But I also believe government has to work, not just posture."
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending September 13th, 2025. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappelle, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Melanie Keller. Stay healthy.
And I'm Joe Bainline. Stay safe.
Sunshine, can't you just feel the moonshine? And ain't it just like a friend of mine to hit me from behind when I'm gone to Carolina in my mind?
This is Dorothy Allison, author of Bastard Out of Carolina and numerous trashy pieces. You're listening to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
Listen, free, listen, that's the way it should be.
So far in 2025, same-gender sex has been outlawed in Trinidad and Tobago and Burkina Faso, and in Indonesia, a pair of gay college students endured 80 lashes. Pride event organizers fought the governments of Turkey and Hungary. Queer events were raided in Malaysia and Russia, and trans rights are under attack almost everywhere. It sure would be a great time for the U.S. to have a top LGBTQI plus diplomat, but not in the second Trump administration. This Way Out's David Hunt finds that the one and only person to ever hold the post continues to unapologetically speak truth to power, and she has some advice for champions of queer human rights in a hostile world.
There was a time when the foreign policy of the United States, under the direction of the U.S. Department of State, advanced democracy around the world and supported the human rights of marginalized people, even people oppressed because of their sexual orientation, gender identity, or gender expression. The State Department even had, for a time, a senior diplomat, a special envoy to advance LGBTQI plus human rights. Under the second Trump administration, not surprisingly, that position is now vacant as the United States retreats from its position of global leadership in diplomacy and human rights. I'm David Hunt. The last U.S. special envoy to advance the human rights of LGBTQI plus persons was Jessica Stern, who was appointed to the post by President Joe Biden in September 2021. She stepped down January 20th, 2025, the day Donald Trump took the presidential oath. Stern is a longtime human rights activist who served for a decade as executive director of Outright International, a nonprofit organization that works to combat violence and discrimination against LGBTQ people. Today, she serves as a senior human rights and U.S. foreign policy fellow at the Carr Ryan Center for Human Rights at the Harvard Kennedy School. I sat down with Stern to discuss her tenure at the State Department and her advice for fellow activists. But first, I noted that we were meeting close to the anniversary of a historic event. On August 24, 2015, almost exactly 10 years ago, the UN Security Council, for the first time ever, held a meeting that focused on LGBTQ human rights. Stern was there and spoke to that gathering of diplomats. I asked her to tell me about that moment in history.
10 years ago was a really harrowing time if you were doing work in solidarity with LGBTQI people in Iraq and Syria. ISIS had taken control of vast parts of those countries, and not only were LGBTQI people unsafe, everybody was unsafe. Women and girls, Yazidis, anyone who didn't conform to an extremist notion of gender conformity and traditional ideals about how to behave in the world. I was the executive director of Outright International, and we did a lot of advocacy at the United Nations because as a global LGBTQI rights organization, it was very clear to us that LGBTQI people in many parts of the world couldn't receive justice within national borders. And the UN, then as now, is an incredibly useful place for LGBTQI activists to turn to help get attention on the world stage to human rights abuses they were experiencing. Unfortunately, when ISIS took control of the country, we were receiving reports, often on a daily basis, of the ways that ISIS was targeting men they perceived to be gay. And so at that moment, we reached out to the US mission to the United Nations. And we said, there's never been a UN Security Council briefing on anything related to LGBTQI issues. And they said, we would be happy to work on this event, but it won't be an official event of the Security Council. We can't get all of the permanent members to agree to an event like this. But what we can do is what's known as an aria, which is basically a side event that influences the official proceedings of the Security Council. And the U.S. reached out to the government of Chile, and Chile agreed to co-sponsor the event. And so thanks to Chile and the United States, we broke the lavender ceiling and we held the first ever LGBTQI event on the margins of the UN Security Council. And it was one of the most emotional UN meetings I'd ever been a part of. We had a Syrian gay man who testified anonymously about what he had experienced at the hands of ISIS. We had a gay Iraqi man who very bravely told his story and gave his name. And I was brought in as the human rights expert to sort of provide the overview. And it was a unique story because ISIS was so deliberate in advertising its murders of men they perceived to be gay. And many of your listeners will probably remember that ISIS would take to social media and show photographs of their agents pushing men they accused of being gay off of the tops of buildings. And David, there was something so harrowing about that, that those images cut across religion and culture and nation, and people everywhere were horrified. And so from that tragedy, we actually found common ground with a lot of unlikely suspects. And in the end, because of the depravity of ISIS, we actually had no formal opposition from any governments. Not a single UN member state protested that aria, which showed that there actually is humanity to be found in this world.
Fast forward five and a half years or so, you have a line on your LinkedIn bio. It says, I led U.S. foreign policy related to LGBTQI plus rights and represented the U.S. government globally. That sentence is doing a lot of heavy lifting. How do you approach a job that big?
When I was invited to entertain the idea of becoming the special envoy for LGBTQI rights, it was a really hard decision. I asked myself, did I want to take on the affiliation with U.S. foreign policy, which, as we know, has not always been respectful of human rights and national sovereignty of other countries. But in the end, it was not a very hard decision to make because LGBTQI people around the world are radically under-resourced in terms of political, economic, and sociocultural support. And we need allies. We need powerful allies. We had a brand new tool in diplomacy, and we had the potential to really shape it, shape its existence, shape its impact, ensure that it acted with integrity. So with a little bit of hemming and hawing, with a lot of support from my partner who agreed to move to Washington, D.C. for 4 years, with a lot of love from my extraordinary community at Outright International, where I'd been executive director for a decade, I packed my bags and took the job. And off to Washington I went.
You're listening to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm David Hunt, continuing my conversation with activist and educator Jessica Stern, the U.S. Special Envoy for LGBTQ plus human rights in the Biden administration. I asked Stern where she thought U.S. policy had done the most to advance LGBTQ human rights during her tenure at the State Department.
In my time in the State Department, we placed an enormous focus on activating U.S. foreign policy so that all aspects from national security to economic development to public health had some relationship to LGBTQI plus rights. And that is absolutely essential, because if LGBTQI issues are just seen as a niche concern, then we never get enough resources. And so one of the things I would always say is, please don't just invite me to your pride party. Don't just bake rainbow cupcakes. Do U.S. foreign policy and include and prioritize the experiences of LGBTQI plus people. And we made a lot of progress with that. You know, I can remember one time there was a proposed sodomy law making its way through a particular country's legislative process. And I found out that the U.S. Secretary of State, Secretary Blinken, was going to be meeting with that country's foreign minister. And I worked every connection that I had. And I eventually ended up in that meeting, sitting at the right hand of the Secretary of State, so that even if I did nothing other than say my title, their government knew that the U.S. was watching and the U.S. was concerned. And in the end, I didn't actually need to say anything because Secretary Blinken delivered the LGBTQI plus talking points for me, for us, for everyone. The second area I would say is working in the global arena with other governments that are supportive of LGBTQI plus rights. David, there just aren't a lot of governments that are putting political and financial energy into the human rights of LGBTQI people. And so when Uganda introduced its Anti-Homosexuality Act, when Hungary banned Pride, when Russia announced that the so-called international LGBTQ movement was a terrorist force, there weren't that many governments that metaphorically raised their hands and said, this is a problem. But because the U.S. has so much global influence, and because our State Department and USAID, when it existed, may it rest in peace, just had so much capacity that other governments didn't, we were able to help anchor responsible engagement by governments that cared about LGBTQI people around the world. And then I think the third and final piece that really felt like a huge success is more LGBTQI people around the world in situations of danger felt like there was someone they could call in times of crisis. And that really meant the most to me. You know, after I left government, I met with one of the smartest, most talented lawyers that I know who works in East Africa. And she said, I don't love that the U.S. has such a big impact on the world. In fact, I'd be the first to critique it. But I want to tell you that when you were in your role, if something bad happened, I knew that there was someone I could call and someone would pick up the phone. And right now, I really ask myself, when something bad happens, who do they call? And is there anyone who will pick up the phone?
Yeah, it's a new world with the Trump administration. And a lot of LGBTQ people and organizations are in despair over the political environment in the U.S. Do you have a message for them of how to meet the moment?
I would start by remembering our community, that we have been here before and we have come through it, but we have come through it by not staying silent. The way we come through moments like this is by protesting, by taking to the streets, by writing letters to the editor, by holding our elected officials accountable, by electing different public officials if the ones we have now don't serve us, by making donations to organizations that serve our community, by inventing new strategies for visibility when rainbow crosswalks get paved over in black tar. We know how to rise up. And the number one thing I would say to all of our listeners is, if you are in a moment of despair, the way to get through this moment of despair is to be loud and to mobilize so that we make this moment as short as possible and we come through it stronger together.
I'd like to thank Jessica Stern for talking with me for this program. Stern is a senior human rights and U.S. foreign policy fellow at the Carr Ryan Center at Harvard. She served in the Biden administration as the U.S. Special Envoy advancing the human rights of LGBTQI plus persons. For This Way Out, I'm David Hunt.
We're gonna work for change together. Work for change together. Work for change together. Never turning back.
never turning back.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. News Wrap was reported this week by Joe Bainline and Melanie Keller and produced by Brian DeShazer. David Hunt produced this week's feature. Rachel Berenger, the Marshall Tucker Band, the Rascals, Ian Post, and Judy Small performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks Richard Merck and Brad Payton celebrating their 50th year together, Brad Furr of KGAY Palm Springs, California, and all the listener donors who make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write to us at Post Office Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. We thank you for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts, and on WWSX Rehoboth Beach, Delaware, 2XX Canberra, Australian Capital Territory, KKFI Kansas City, Missouri, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned, y'all.
Sequoia Ezekiwe for Ear to the Streets of Portland on the best community radio station on the planet, KB Community Radio, KBOO Portland.